Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument on the February term is State of South Dakota versus Nicholas Cummings. The appellant, State of South Dakota, is represented by John Gulen, the Deputy Attorney General from Pierre, and the appellee is represented by Rena Atchison, an attorney from Rapid City. Mr. Gulen, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court. My name is John Gulen. I'm representing the state in this case. This case presents the issue of the fresh pursuit of an Indian from a place off the reservation to a place on the reservation. The facts seem to be uncontested. The defendant was cited off reservation in Fall River County speeding. Deputy Sheriff turned around, began to follow the defendant. The defendant passed over the center line. A chase ensued. The defendant speeded up to 90 miles per hour, still off the reservation. Then the sirens and the siren was going, the lights were going. The defendant finally made it onto the reservation where he slowed down and stopped about from a half mile to a mile within the reservation. At that point, deputy sheriff removed the defendant from the car. After ascertaining who he was back in the car. He talked to defendant talked to the deputy sheriff. A statement was taken, and that becomes what the issue in this case was. The more complete statement of the issue then is, can the state pursue an Indian who is reasonably suspected of committing an off-reservation crime onto the reservation, stop and interview him, use the statement. Magistrate court below said no, and the magistrate court, we submit, erred. The magistrate court erred because it did not follow the decision of the United States Supreme Court in Nevada v. Hicks. The error of the magistrate court, we think, was egregious because it did not even cite that case. But we believe that Nevada v. Hicks does, in fact, control. Nevada v. Hicks concerns a case very much like this case. There was an allegation that a tribal member had committed a crime off-reservation. The off-reservation crime was apparently the taking of illegal taking of bighorn sheep. Evidence came to the attention of the state authorities that the bighorn sheep were, in fact, on display in the tribal member's home on the reservation. A search warrant was obtained from a state court for an on-reservation search. The on-reservation search was carried out on tribal land against the tribal members, in the tribal member's home on the reservation. I think, unfortunately, there was no evidence actually uncovered. But there was a suit begun by the tribal member against the warden who actually executed the search warrant on the reservation. At that point, a federal court action was begun to prevent the tribal court from proceeding, and the issue before the federal court was whether the tribal court had jurisdiction over the state office and the performance of its duties. And after much litigation, the Hicks court answered that question no. And it's the rationale of the Hicks court which we think determines the question before this court. In Seminole Tribe, the Supreme Court established that the binding nature of Supreme Court precedent is not only the precise holding of the case, but the rationale that necessarily underlies that case. And it is the rationale of the Hicks case which points, definitely to the decision that this court should come to in this case.
Just as a point of information, did you you say the magistrate did not cite to Nevada versus Hicks?
That's right, Your Honor.
Had you cited Nevada versus Hicks to the magistrate?
It had been cited by the state's attorney, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you see Hicks as creating a new doctrine in tribal-state relations, or without Hicks, would you be making the same argument today?
It would be difficult to make the same argument based on State versus Spotted Horse. Leaving Spotted Horse aside, I would point out that the article that the defendant has cited by Judy Royster and one other person did point out that at least in 1988, the cases which had decided the question seemed to indicate that the state did have the right to go on the reservations to enforce its law. But the doctrine is not well developed. The doctrine was not put together until Nevada v. Hicks.
Okay.
Has any other state or federal court, since Hicks, decided the way you wish us to decide today?
As far as I can tell, Your Honor, no court has specifically addressed the question one way or another. My view on that is that the issue is so clear that the issue is not simply not being taken up.
You're saying either way.
That's right, Your Honor. The overall issue in Hicks was whether the tribe had jurisdiction over a state warden in the performance of his duties. And to answer that question, the Supreme Court reviewed its precedent, and especially Montana versus United States, which is as the Supreme Court has now said several times, the pathfinding case regarding jurisdiction. Under Montana, the general rule is that the inherent sovereign authority of a tribe does not extend to non-members of the tribe. So, of course, under the general rule, the tribe would have had no jurisdiction. But there are two exceptions under Montana to that general rule, and the second exception is what is important here. The second exception is that the tribe may, in some circumstances, have jurisdiction over non-members if it is necessary to protect tribal self-government or control internal relations. And it's the court's answer to that question, and it's rationale for answering that question that answers the question in this case.
And Mr. Guillen, that exception was not the basis for the Spotted Horse decision. That wasn't the rationale.
No, it was not, Your Honor.
How would that make any? Why would that give us cause to overrule Spotted Horse under the second Montana exception?
Well, the precise rationale of Spotted Horse is, quite frankly, difficult to understand. There were two rationales in Spotted Horse. The first was that the state did not have Public Law 280 jurisdiction. And that's not at issue here. We are not claiming, South Dakota does not claim that it got Public Law 280 jurisdiction in this case. The second part of Spotted Horse was the very brief statement on pages at 462 Northwest 2nd at 467 that South Dakota does not have jurisdiction on the reservation. That statement is repeated twice, and it forms the basis for the remainder of the decision. The court does not indicate precisely why that is so, but the court does say that, and it's that statement that forms the basis for the rest of the decision. The question is whether or not that statement was correct, and it is our contention that that statement was not correct. And it is not correct because of the rationale we contend in that the Supreme Court set out in Hicks. And what was that rationale? The second exception says that the tribe may have jurisdiction over non-members if it's necessary to protect tribal self-government or control internal relations. Okay. So the rationale. So to look at that, to determine how that came out, the Supreme Court looked at two questions. It looked at the authority and interest of the state and the authority and interest of the tribe. With regard to the authority and interest of the state, the court made several statements, several findings, which are, we think, compelling. First, the court said the state authority does not end at a reservation's border. Second, the court said ordinarily an Indian reservation is considered part of the territory of a state. And the court also said that when the state interests were implicated, the states may in some circumstances regulate the activity even of members on tribal land on the reservation. And very importantly for our case, the court went the next step and said that the state did have a compelling interest in executing its search warrant with regard to an off-reservation crime on an Indian on a reservation. And the court said that all this was necessary to ensure the ability of the state to keep reservations from becoming asylums for fugitives from justice. Your Honor, it's our view that, well, the second part, before I go to the next step, the second part of the court's rationale was to look at the tribe's interest. And the tribe's interest in Nevada v. Hicks were definitely de minimis. What the court said, how the court summarized the tribe's interest, was that the tribe's self-government interests were not offended simply because the state executes its process on the tribe's reservation. And the court came to that conclusion because it looked at the relationship between the relationship between the federal government and the state, and it said when the federal government serves its process within the state's interests are not implicated. And so it said, by analogy, when the state serves its process, on a reservation, the tribe's interests were not implicated. And so from all that, it concluded that the tribe lacked a sovereign interest in regulating the state officer executing a search warrant on tribal land on a reservation.
Would Hicks have been decided differently if the state had not gone to the tribal court, had not gotten the tribal warrant, had not used tribal officers?
I think the answer to that is definitely no, Your Honor. And I base that on the majority opinion at 533 U.S. at 372, stating flatly that the tribal search warrant was unnecessary. Justice Scalia made the aside, I think, to deal precisely with the possibility that that question might arise. But Justice Scalia said, for the majority, that tribal search warrant was unnecessary. So we think that does not figure at all in the equation. It cannot figure at all in the equation because the Supreme Court said it did not fit.
Speaking of Justice Scalia, how do you count noses in that case as far as the justices that joined the rationale of Justice Scalia? If you don't have it readily at hand, that's okay. I'm just wondering if you had, in your research of this, had looked at that and tried to consider.
Justice Ginsburg's decision would have been a more narrow decision. Justices Stevens and Breyer, I think, had some real doubts about the accuracy of the decision. I think there were 6 solid votes when you had it all tallied up. That's the way we looked at it.
How can you say that when Justice Souter took the position that he would go right to Montana's rule that a tribe's civil jurisdiction generally stops short of non-member defendants?
Because of the language just quoted, Your Honor. It seems to us that what Justice Souter...
concurring in result.
It's
he's not concurring specially with Justice Scalia.
The way we read Justice Souter's opinion, is that Justice Souter would have gone further than Justice Scalia in the state's favor. And that what Justice Souter was really saying is that the Montana, it was really an elaboration of the Montana rule. The Montana rule is often connected to the question of whether or not particular land is in tribal hands or non-Indian hands. And we think that what Justice Souter was really saying is that part of Montana doesn't make any sense because it leads to a kind of jurisdiction which is unknowable from one parcel of land to another, checkerboarding. And we think what Justice Souter is getting at, and we think what Justice Souter is eventually going to say in a majority opinion, is that the Montana rule does not really have anything to do with whether the land is tribal land or non-tribal land. It's a factor, but it isn't something that makes the Montana rule applicable or non-applicable. We think the court is moving in that direction. So we see Justice Souter's opinion is actually more favorable to the state than Justice Scalia's opinion. The court's rationale in Hicks makes it clear to the state that the state, in fact, does have authority to send its officer in hot pursuit. First, the quality of intrusion on a public highway is less than the intrusion that the Supreme Court endorsed in Hicks. This is an intrusion on a public highway. It's a stop. It's a taking of a statement. What they did in Hicks was actually to go on the reservation onto a tribal member's home. The homes are protected by the Constitution more than any other place. It seems to us that the quality of intrusion here is less than the one at issue in Hicks. Second, the court citation of a circuit court decision, Arizona Ex Rel Merrill v. Turtle at footnote 8, seems to us to be significant. In the Turtle case, the Court of Appeals held that, I should tell you what the facts are. The facts in that case, much abbreviated, were that an arrest was made on a reservation on the basis of a governor's warrant without a judicial warrant. And the Court of Appeals in that case said that arrest was no good, the state arrest was no good, because there had to be an extradition agreement between the state and the tribe. And the Supreme Court in Hicks at footnote 8 seems to us to be saying that's not true, that's not the way the cases are, this case is inconsistent with the decision we're making. And third, there's other language in Hicks which makes it very clear that the court expected its decision to be read broadly. For example, the court said, nothing in the federal statutory scheme even remotely suggests that state officers cannot enter a reservation to investigate or prosecute violations of state law off the reservations. Seems to us that this language is precisely on point. And then it said with regard to tortious conduct, he said, state officers operating on a reservation to investigate off-reservation violations of state law are properly held to answer both either in federal court or in state court, clearly expecting the state officers to be on there. And if the state officers then would commit a tort, for example, assaulting a defendant or something like that, then he would be, then that state officer would be subject to federal or state civil rights.
If we accept your argument as correct, does the same right then go to the tribal law enforcement officials to come onto state property if they're in hot pursuit of a tribal member?
It does not, Your Honor. And the reason is that the reservation is part of the state. And that's what the Supreme Court has now squarely held in Hicks. But the reservation boundaries, the jurisdiction of the tribal court never extends beyond the reservation boundaries. It cannot. The reservation has no claim to the rest of the state or to the rest of the country, for that matter. So it does not go both ways. And it does not go both ways because of the nature of the federal system. Reservations are found within states. And that is the geographic and actual fact. So it does not go both ways, Your Honor.
So you're saying that the state government can go on the reservation and in the absence of a compact with the tribe, they can go on the reservation at any time and any place to enforce crimes committed off the reservation.
That's right.
And to obtain the evidence from the reservation to support that.
They can do, a state officer can do what is legitimate off the reservation, on the reservation.
Without contacting the tribal law enforcement officers, without having a compact with them, without anything.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
In other words, it's free territory. They can go in there anytime, any place.
Reservations are part of the state. And that is the rule, I think, set out in Nevada v. Hicks. It is a rule that the tribes have resisted, but it is nonetheless the rule. Reservations are part of the state. Reservation residents vote in state elections. Reservation residents obtain social services from the state. Reservation residents are serving in the state legislature, as we talked this morning. Reservations are indeed part of the state, and that's what the Supreme Court held. It's an accurate description of the reality.
Are these incursions limited to exigent circumstances like we have here, or can it be just part of the policy of the state of South Dakota to enter onto a reservation at the time of their own choosing to arrest a person who has a warrant outstanding in the state?
Well, if the court is talking about what I believe the law to be, I believe it does not require exigent circumstances. I don't see anything in Hicks that requires exigent circumstances. On the other hand, it should be pointed out that the policy of the state of South Dakota to work with tribes, and let me point out two things in that regard.
Do they have a compact?
We do not.
Huh?
No, we do not.
Is there anything in the record that supports their attempting to get a compact?
For extradition?
Yeah.
I don't believe so.
What's the policy worth if we've got nothing in the record to support that they've attempted to get a compact?
Well, what is in the record is the Law Review article that the defendant submitted, again by Judy Royster. It surveyed looking for compacts, and the only compact it found was one back with the state of South Dakota has with the Sisseton. I think that indicates that the state of South Dakota is in fact willing to enter into compacts. We do have a compact.
Doesn't that only mean that they were willing to enter in a compact with Sisseton back whenever they did that?
It's still in force.
Well, I know, but I mean, that doesn't show anything as to any other tribe. There's 8 other tribes in the state.
There was no opportunity for anybody to set forth compacts or not compacts. But anyway, the state did not. And of course, there wasn't any negative evidence. We would be happy to, I believe I could put on some pretty good evidence that the tribes don't want the compacts, but we did not do that. So the court is correct.
I think we'll take the record as it is that there is no compact.
There is no compact. What the state did do in this case, though, is to notify the tribal officers that The deputy sheriff was coming on the reservation. It's our policy to do that. We want good relationships with the tribes. We're not trying to use this as a way to railroad anybody. It is a matter of keeping the reservations from becoming asylums for fugitives from justice. That is exactly what was occurring here. This defendant, at least the evidence shows, was traveling 90 miles an hour off the reservation. He was a fugitive. He was looking for the reservation as an asylum from justice. The state intervened. The state did precisely what the Supreme Court expected it to do. Nothing the state did was improper. Everything the state did was exactly in accordance with Hicks. I should point out also in Hicks that the Supreme Court, Justice O'Connor's, I think it was noted that there were compacts in other states. There was no compact in Hicks. It didn't make any difference in that case, and of course it shouldn't make any difference here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Guillen. Okay. Ms. Atchison, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. It's an honor to be here. My name is Rena Atchison. I represent Nicholas Cummings. I've never had the opportunity to appear before you personally, and I do have a cold as well, so if I lose my voice or something like that, please bear with me. I represent Mr. Cummings. He traveled up here to watch this. This is a very critical case to him because of his profession. He is an over-the-road truck driver, and any conviction in this case could severely impact his ability to care for his family. And I think that's kind of been lost in all the discussion over Indian jurisdiction and the issues here, and I want to make sure that this case is extremely critical to Mr. Cummings, even though it may be seen as a misdemeanor case or something of that nature. It is definitely very serious for him.
Of course, even under spotted horse, that would support the conviction of the evidence obtained off the reservation, wouldn't it?
Correct, Your Honor. The critical issue here is that they would not have even known the identity of Mr. Cummings would not have been revealed. He could not have testified as to who was actually driving the vehicle because he didn't know who was driving the vehicle off of the reservation. So that would have been critical in order to tie up the issue of speeding. Also,
is that true in Spotted Horse also?
I am not exactly sure. It's from my understanding he actually knew who the individual was driving the vehicle before they even left the city limits, but it's not clear in Spotted Horse, Your Honor.
Is this vehicle that was being driven, is that licensed to Mr. Cummings?
Yes, it is. I believe the evidence would show that it's licensed, registered, and insured, all three under his name.
So there's some probability, at least, that you have that connection, even if you don't have it for sure until you get to...
There's a potential. It would have just limited the state's ability to prove who was actually driving or operating the motor vehicle off the reservation.
Well, that's more than just a limitation. I mean, that's... if you don't catch him, you don't have a case.
Basically, that's our argument. When going through this and trying to figure out how you were supposed to look at this issue, it was very difficult for me because not only do you have the cautions in the area of Indian jurisdiction, but you also have the cautions put forward for you in criminal law. So it's like you have these two areas that are operating simultaneously, one being the area of Indian jurisdiction and the authority of law enforcement officers in Indian territory, and at the same time you have the criminal rights of the defendant. And when those two things are operating together simultaneously, it's very difficult to figure out where one begins and the other one ends.
But it seems to me this is simply an Indian jurisdiction case because there's nothing novel or new about the concept of fresh pursuit. I mean, that law is well established.
No, but there...
I'm not suggesting that we should decide this because of criminal law principles.
No, but I am saying, in addition to the Indian jurisdiction issues here, there is also the issue, there was an argument put forth by the state that all of the statements made by Mr. Cummings should be admissible. And if you look at the Fifth Amendment and how those issues come down, even if you find that the arrest was proper, the statements should not necessarily be admissible because you still have the Fifth Amendment to deal with. And in this case, Mr. Cummings actually asked for a lawyer, refused to talk, and there were conversations that took place when he was clearly under arrest without Miranda being read to him that took place prior to Miranda being read. So I want to make sure that we don't forget those bright line criminal rules that are out there for us under the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, just because it looks like, and you know, everything up to this point has been talked about as Indian jurisdiction.
Well, the state spent its full 20 minutes of Indian jurisdiction. Perhaps you'd like to respond in that area.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to point out two caveats in the Hicks opinion. The first is the footnote in the majority, footnote number 2, and it's at page 358 of the United States. Our holding in this case is limited to the question of tribal court jurisdiction over state officers enforcing state law. The second one is at 373 in the same. Of course, an individual would be able to invoke the authority, and I left out, of the state government and state courts to vindicate constitutional or other federal and state law rights. We are not talking about tribal court. Number one, Hicks stands for tribal court jurisdiction. Not even criminal jurisdiction, civil jurisdiction. Number two, Hicks stands, as I believe it was Justice Sabers pointed out, the law enforcement officers there, it was not a hot pursuit. It was an incident where they actually had information. They went forward to the state court with a search warrant. They went forward to the tribal court with a search warrant. And then they used the tribal officers to execute the search warrant. None of that is here.
So what do you think of your opponent's argument that that Justice Souter's opinion would have gone, goes actually further than Justice Scalia's opinion?
In the area of civil jurisdiction, yes, under Montana versus United States. But Justice Souter takes he separates civil jurisdiction from criminal jurisdiction. He says, this should not be going over into the criminal arena. You don't even need to get to that area to talk about what's appropriate under Montana versus the United States. So yes, he would have gone farther as far as determining tribal court's civil jurisdiction, but he certainly kind of dissects himself from the part of the rationale where Justice Scalia goes through and talks about criminal jurisdiction in Indian country.
So you're saying what Justice Scalia says as to anything in relation to criminal jurisdiction is just dicta and not necessary even to the holding, and that he didn't have the support of any other justices except the two that voted with him.
Yes, and when you try to, I was trying to, when you had asked the question regarding where do all of the justices fall for the United States Supreme Court on this, you can't tell. I went through it a couple different times. I tried to go through it one more time this morning. You cannot tell exactly where they fall on every part of it. I think Frank Pomerantz said, in Nevada v. Hicks, there's a little bit of something for everyone in Nevada v. Hicks. There's just a little bit of something in there for everyone. And so when you take the cautions that are given to us in the legal field, not only under Indian jurisdiction, but under criminal jurisdiction, why would you take a case that is so clearly scattered all over the place to stand for a proposition that you have jurisdiction when the facts are not even parallel? They don't even match up.
I was the one that asked the Nose County question, and if you counted this morning, then tell me this. What did Souter, Kennedy, and Thomas mean when they said that they join the analysis and conclusions? doesn't that suggest that they did agree with the
rationale?
The rationale used by Justice Scalia.
I believe that their main point was that they would have gone and done a different analysis under 1983, Section 1983, and they gave limited discussion. But however, the whole part that they discuss is clearly Montana versus the United States, and in the realm of civil jurisdiction. They never, that opinion, that concurring opinion, not once goes into the area of criminal jurisdiction by state authorities. So I don't believe that they're on point and with the rationale as to criminal jurisdiction on reservations. I think that they're only in concurrence with the discussion pursuant to Montana versus the United States and how you determine civil jurisdiction. The other case that has not been discussed at any great length is the case Bradley versus Deloria, which is actually service of process in the state of South Dakota in a civil case. To make sure I have the correct site, excuse me. In that case, this court determined that if you do not follow state law in serving process on the reservation, you are foreclosed and that process is considered bunked, not sufficient in order to continue forward in a civil suit. In this case, there is no state law that permits incursions onto the reservation. It is completely absent. If you look at, I believe...
What about spotted horse?
What do you mean, and what about spotted horse?
Well, that permits entrance on the reservation.
It,
to the extent of making an arrest for further prosecuting crimes off the reservation.
They did not condone, Spotted Horse did not condone the actual arrest. They indicated, I believe that they cited Winkler in determining that even if someone does end up in state hands pursuant to an illegal arrest, the actual being and having the person is still acceptable. But then the penalty is that you don't get to use any of the evidence in doing that illegal action. I don't believe that Spotted Horse condoned it in any way, shape, or form. I believe they said, well, clearly we have this individual now in our custody, and we have to determine what we're going to do with that because they didn't follow extradition procedures, and there's an illegal bringing them back. It doesn't mean that they don't face prosecution. It just means that none of the evidence used in that could be presented in forwardance of the prosecution.
I don't see how you can go that far to say that that they didn't use the identity from the arrest on the reservation in order to convict of crimes committed off the reservation.
Clearly, in Bradley versus Deloria, which is 587 Northwest 2nd 591, 1998 South Dakota 129, they look specifically at state statute as to how you could bring this person into state court, how you could make them accountable for something that occurred off the reservation. And it was clear that the only authority that was given in that case was statutory authority under the service of process statutes. And in this case, there's not even state statutory authority. The state has not even passed a statute that gives guidance to its law enforcement officers on what to do in this situation.
Well, so if we buy the state's argument that the reservation is part of the state, then we wouldn't need any special statute to deal with.
Well, there are statutes that talk about a city going to a city, a county going into another county. the statutory framework, I mean, there's even cases in this court's history where somebody left the scope of their territory, their city territory, and could not go into all, likewise county territory. And I don't know how you can, they're state citizens to a, I mean, this goes back to the piecemeal way that South Dakota tried to pass Public Law 280. We're going to take the pieces when we want to take the pieces. They're going to be state citizens when we, the state, decide that it's that it works for us and that it's going to be cost effective or meets an end that the state wants. But there's never a discussion about the tribal involvement in that. If you do it that way, okay, in criminal jurisdiction, we're going to do this. But by the way, we're not going to pay taxes associated with that back into the reservation. Take Shannon County. You know, we're not going to put any money into that county, but we're certainly going to allow our law enforcement officers to make incursions and go onto the reservation.
Go ahead and finish.
I apologize.
No, go ahead.
I don't know what I was going to say now.
maybe I don't either. But in Spotted Horse, how did the state get Mr. Spotted Horse back into Mobridge in order to prosecute him?
They actually took him and returned to Mobridge with him.
And in this case, and obviously they had his identity known then at that time. Okay. And in this case, what did they do with Mr. Cummings when they stopped him?
They turned him over to the tribal police. I believe the stop occurred, it was at least a half an hour after the stop had occurred, but sometime within half an hour, 45 minutes after he was turned over to the Oglala Sioux Tribal, I believe it's called the Department of Public Safety.
And how did they get him back to Fall River County for prosecution?
He voluntarily appeared. The sheriff, I don't believe it's in the record, I don't believe that was testified to, but through my representation, there was a telephone call made from the sheriff's office, the Fall River County Sheriff's Office, to Mr. Cummings. He was told that there was a warrant, and he actually voluntarily went in and picked up the warrant. We had actually challenged jurisdiction initially. I believe that you'll see that if you look at the pleadings, but then we conceded jurisdiction. As far as being able to actually prosecute him for the crime personally, we conceded that portion of it.
Along that line, as I read the appendix to your brief, it looked to me like the extradition provision of the tribe only extends to felonies, so it would not be available in this case. Is that correct?
I believe you're correct in that, Your Honor. I do know that down there that they have in misdemeanor cases went ahead and extradited, but it's not specifically allowed within the code itself. But in this case, Mr. Cummings voluntarily turned himself in. It's also interesting, I was when listening to the discussion on policy, it's not like Spotted Horse happened yesterday. Spotted Horse has been out there for 13 years. There's been no additional legislation passed by the state of South Dakota. There have been no additional compacts reached since that time. There has basically been virtually nothing that you can see on paper that has happened in order to determine what should happen in this case. And I do agree with the Spotted Horse opinion that there are compelling reasons to talk about what should happen in this situation. The problem is there has not been a meeting of the minds, a sitting down of the two, potentially three jurisdictions that this affects. And to make one criminal defendant bear the burden of the inability of the state to sit down and reach agreements with these, because really it's, we're talking federal, tribal, and state, and this is a county deputy sheriff, so potentially four jurisdictions. Things are very heated down there. Bennett County incursions onto the reservation. It hit the newspapers. This is a very important and a critical issue. And for the state to argue a case, Nevada v. Hicks, which I again submit to you, factually it does not apply. When you look at the rationale, it seems flawed, because what you're talking about is civil regulatory jurisdiction. When you're weighing and balancing the interests of the two, that is clearly a civil jurisdiction argument and a test. Montana v. U.S., civil. It does not go through 18 U.S.C. 1151, 18 U.S.C. 1152, 18 U.S.C. 1153. Those are the basic federal framework that was in place back in 1990 when Spotted Horse was enacted. It's what's in place now. The state laws, where they tried to take over Public Law 280 jurisdiction, haven't changed. Nothing else has changed, except there's a United States Supreme Court decision that the state would like to use to once again choose piecemeal to take over jurisdiction of some criminal acts on the reservation. I thank you very much this morning for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Gewing, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Your Honor, to make a few comments, first with regard to this particular case and this particular defendant, of course, the state and our office certainly bear no ill will towards Mr. Cummings. It should be pointed out, though, that Mr. Cummings was a deputy sheriff for Fall River County for a couple of years. That's shown on page 20 of the transcript. And when he ran from the state officer, ran from the county officer, he knew what he was doing. And that is something that does bear on this case. With regard to the Miranda issues, there are no Miranda issues in this case. I just took another look at the findings and conclusions proposed by the defendant, which were accepted by the magistrate court. Not a word about Miranda, not a word about improper statements being taken under Miranda. Is the Hicks language merely dictum? Is it merely something that this court can disregard? We would say no on two bases. First, we do believe that the rationale is binding on the court. But even if that is not true, even if you take the view that this is merely dictum, it is considered dictum. The Federal Court of Appeals takes the view that the considered dictum of the United States Supreme Court is almost as binding. That's what the language they used in the City of Timberlake case, almost as binding as the actual holding of the case. And here the language of the Supreme Court that we are referring to is repeated. It's definite. It's clear. Reservation boundaries are not impermeable. The reservations are part of the state. The state does have the right to go on the reservation to serve its process. There was an aside made that I'd like to briefly address, that the state does not support people on the reservations. I would simply say there's no evidence in the record as to this. Again, I could brief this, in fact, have briefed this in a voting rights case now going on in federal court, and it is simply not true. Per capita aid for people on the reservation is greater than per capita aid for people off the reservations. I understand that's not in the record, but none of it's in the record, so it should simply be disregarded.
What do you have to say about her argument that the state cannot even bring back the identity of the person, you know, to later prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, from the stopping and from...
I guess that would leave Spotted Horse in place with a vengeance, Your Honor, because it would go further than Spotted Horse, because certainly we did bring the identity back, and we did prosecute Spotted Horse successfully. As I recall, the bottom line holding in Spotted Horse was that the arrest was illegal, but nonetheless the prosecution could proceed, and that presumes knowing the identity of the person. The rule that the court followed in Spotted Horse with regard to what it was deemed to be an illegal arrest was from Kirby Frisbee. I don't think a long line of cases. I don't think any case has ever taken that view that you couldn't take the identity back. So I would say it's a novel proposition of law, unsupported by any authority that I know of. And I don't believe it is actually raised in this case before. I heard it this morning in argument.
Speaking of Spotted Horse again, if Spotted Horse is grounded on Public Law 280 as well as yes. jurisdiction, and if Hicks has not knocked down the Public Law 280 analysis, then why should Spotted Horse be overruled?
The part of Spotted Horse having to do with PL 280 does not have to be overruled because we are not suggesting that we have jurisdiction under Public Law 280. So that can stay in place. The second question, there are two questions here. Does the state have jurisdiction as a result of Public Law 280? And if not, does the state have jurisdiction otherwise? We're giving up on PL 280 as far as this case goes. We have not raised that below, so we're not arguing it here. But still, we could have jurisdiction otherwise. And in Nevada, there was no PL 280 jurisdiction at stake. So we're just the same as Nevada in that instance. It's just another way we could have jurisdiction is through general law. So that's why we think Spotted Horse is general proposition that regardless of what happened with PL 280, the state doesn't have any jurisdiction on the reservations. We think that line statement by the court in Spotted Horse was incorrect, especially in light of Hicks. And so we think you don't have to deal with the PL 280 question at all. We're not suggesting that the court does.
Well, how can you have, if doesn't Public Law 280 attempt to say there is no jurisdiction unless compliance with its requirements are met?
It says the state cannot gain specified civil and criminal jurisdiction unless it goes to this particular procedure. What the court held in Onahan was that we hadn't gone through that procedure. So we don't get the PL 280 jurisdiction, so we simply put that to one side. But it did not exclude the other state authority that it might have had regardless of PL 280. This case can be considered as if PL 280 had never been enacted, and we'd be in the same position. Or it can be considered just like Nevada. In Nevada, the state had no PL 280 jurisdiction. Did not prevent the court from entering the decision it did. There was some comment on Bradley v. Deloria and how that might be applicable to this case. And the comment was made that there wasn't any state law which permits intrusions onto the reservation. And the fact, I think, as Justice Konenkamp pointed out, is that the Supreme Court in Hicks said, we think that reservations are part of the state. So naturally, there would be no state law. There isn't any special state law that says the state can provide social services on the reservation. There isn't any state law that says the state can hold elections on the reservations. There isn't any particular state law that allows the myriad of things that the state does in Shannon County, the same as in Brown County or in Hughes County. That doesn't need to be because reservations are part of the state. They always have been, and now the Supreme Court has said specifically that they are. There's also a comment made with regard to the complexity of federal law and how that should affect the result in this case. I think that question does deserve an answer. Federal Indian law is complex, and that is why the courts look to the United States Supreme Court as the final body to make decisions with regard to that. Actually, there are two reasons. One is that Indian law is quintessentially federal law. The Supreme Court is the final arbiter of federal law. Sometimes we agree with it, sometimes we don't agree with it, but it is the final law. And the Supreme Court has now spoken in Nevada v. Hicks, and that's it. But even if that were not it, it's a good thing that the Supreme Court is there, because then the Supreme Court makes uniform law for the United States, for all the states, with regard to Indian jurisdiction matters. It has made it here. It has cut through the complexity, and it has made one thing clear in Indian law. And that thing is that in the context of this particular case, is the state can go on reservations in hot pursuit of a person who has committed an off-reservation crime. In fact, what the Supreme Court has done is answered this court's question, this court's call for help in Spotted Horse. In Spotted Horse, the court said, we feel compelled to comment on the need for a solution to this gap in criminal jurisdiction. When a crime is committed off the reservation and criminals can flee unimpeded onto the reservation, both Indians and non-Indians alike are harmed. What the court looked for was negotiation between the tribes and the state to work it out. It hasn't happened. It's really, quite frankly, unlikely to happen. It's very difficult to come to these kinds of agreements. What the court has said, you don't need agreements. What the court has said, reservations are not asylums from justice for fleeing criminals. What the court has said is that the state of South Dakota and the other states of the union, you don't actually have this problem. As a matter of federal law, we, the final arbiters, decide that your state officers can go on the reservation to pursue a fleeing suspect. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Gunn. The court will be in recess until 10 o'clock. Thank you.